The name of this program is The Poet and the Poem. I am Grace Cavalieri, and today we are in Sterling Brown's house. Sterling Brown is America's poet. Sterling is the author of Southern Road, editor of The Negro Caravan, author of Negro in Poetry and Drama, The Negro in American Fiction, The Last Ride of Wild Bill, just issued by Broadside Press in 74. A book of essays is forthcoming from Howard University. Sterling is the author of more than 100 essays on literature, criticism, and music. And we will now hear the voice of Sterling Brown.
After winter, he snuggles his fingers in the blacker loam. The lean months are done with, the fat to come. His eyes are set on a brushwood fire, but his heart is soaring higher and higher. Though he stands ragged, an old scarecrow, this is the way his swift thoughts go. Butter beans for Clara, sugar corn for Grace, and for the little fella, running space. Radishes and lettuce, eggplants and beets, turnips for the winter and candied sweets. Homespun tobacco, apples in the bin, for smoking and for cider when the folk straps in. He thinks with the winter, his troubles are gone. 10 acres unplanted to raise dreams on. The lean months are done with, the fat to come. His hopes, winter wanderers, hasten home. Butter beans for Clara, sugar corn for Grace. And for the little fella, run in space.
It's imperative that people hear the voice of Sterling Brown, because I know that I will never be able to read your poetry again without hearing your voice. I think Sterling Stuckey talked about the earth in your voice. Would you tell us a little about that poem, Sterling?
The poem is hard to read because it's somewhat autobiographical. Two of my sisters were named Clara and Grace. I had 5 sisters. I couldn't get all of them in the poem. And I'm the little fella. And my father bought a farm outside of Laurel, Maryland. And the poem is closely related to my autobiography.
I would like to recapitulate your history, which is certainly a laugh to do and try to do in one sentence. I do want the world to know that Sterling Brown was born in 1901 in Washington, D.C., the son of a minister. Sterling Brown taught at Virginia Seminary, at Fisk, at Lincoln, was a visiting lecturer at Atlanta University, at NYU, and at Howard, where he was a professor for 30 years.
Vassar, too.
Vassar, right. A scholar at Williams and Harvard, originally. And I first want to talk to Sterling Brown, the teacher, because I think great teachers are very rare, and you're remembered in this community, in this world, as a great teacher. Sterling, the thing which you have in your work, that authentic voice, how is it possible to teach a young person to find the truth in himself, his continuity? How can we inspire people to reach down so far to find where they came from? How can we do that?
Well, I don't know the answer to that. I am a teacher. I love my poetry. I wanted to write. I could not make a living writing. I went into teaching. I succeeded as a teacher. I have learned that in the last 5 years.
I taught, I think I told you that this summer I had a chance to teach American students abroad for just a short time, and I had tutorial sessions with them on a one-to-one basis. And maybe all a teacher can be is a model, or maybe all a teacher can do is use other teachers as models. For when I shared your work, I think they finally understood what it was to find one's own tradition. Maybe that's all the best we can do.
I never thought of myself as a model. I did teach one-on-one. I am still teaching one-on-one. I have had classes of 150 students. Students had to take a course in the introduction to literature. It met in the chemistry laboratory auditorium, and I didn't know them. People took the roll by numbers, and during World War II, when I was visiting Tuskegee, where the 99th was training, I met many of my students there, and one of them yelled at me, one of them who was a grease monkey under the plane, yelled at me, "Hello, Prof, I was seat number 136. And so I taught by the wholesale, and yet I was a one-on-one teacher. I still am. I cannot go to Howard now, where I try to go in Monday, Wednesday, and Friday without somebody else coming in the door with problems. They brought me all kinds of problems, not about Shakespeare's prosody, not about Pope's sarcasm, not about Hardy's pessimism, but they came to me about their problems. They came to me for money. They came to me for books. They came to me for advice. They came to me, period, just to sit down. They saw me in there, sitting down, perhaps not writing, and perhaps not reading, so they thought I was loafing and that I needed companionship. My wife and I have, in the last 5 years, received proof that I was a good teacher. I never thought of myself as a good teacher. I was one of the Young Turks under Mordecai Johnson, with such other Young Turks as Ralph Bunche and Abe Harris and Franklin Frazier and Rayford Logan and Harold Lewis and Sam Dorsey. This is a list of men whom I honor and respect, and these were my peers. I never thought of myself as a superior teacher to them. I never thought of myself necessarily as a great teacher, but with all the conceit in the world, the letters that we have received and the visits coming from Africa, coming from Kenya, coming from Germany, coming from New York, coming from Hoboken, coming from Boston, coming from South Boston, Virginia, and all over. I have students who have sent us words of gratitude and respect. And Howard University last year, they had a program for me, as did the Pacifica group had a program, which both of which were flattering, both of which were undue, and both of which were lovely, and so they have made me believe that my teaching was a success. I never wrote as much as I wanted. I feel guilty sometimes at the gathering of poets because it has been long since I have written poetry, but the poetry still speaks to many students, and it spoke to the students in the 60s, and it's still speaking to the students in the 70s. For a long time, after my second book of poems was turned down, that was a shock, and I didn't know where my poems were. I couldn't tell you, but there are people like Sterling Stuckey and Steve Henderson and Michael Harper and Bob Steptoe Jail, and there's many others who've had much to do with what I call rediscovering me, reviving me, renovating me, all the other, but not revising me.
You have some famous students as well. I know Ossie Davis says that you were the only man who spoke to him on campus the first time he was there.
Ossie Davis is over. I taught Ossie Davis hyperbole. Ossie is lying slightly, but Ossie was a student of mine that I paid attention to because I knew he had a lot on. If he hadn't had a lot on the ball, I still would have liked him. He was from Waycross, Georgia, and they kidded him around about that. But he had a good mind, and he says that I taught him Queequeg. I taught Moby Dick, and he had the difficulty with Moby Dick that I had when I was an undergraduate. I think it's one of the greatest books in the world, but it is a tough book. And it's a tough book for a boy coming out of Waycross, Georgia, where there are not too many white whales. And so Ossie and I struck up a friendship. And he and Ruby Dee have overpaid it. I am one of their role models. It is an indication that they are not too well educated because they're making big mistakes, but his hyperbole pleases me greatly, and I'm glad he taught me Queequeg. I'm glad I taught him Queequeg because he taught me a lot about people.
Mm. People is the right word for your poetry because each of your poems could be a full play. Since you are a dramatist,
yes,
as you are being a poet,
I directed the Howard Players before they had a department of drama. You'd teach 15 hours, and then you would coach the players, and if need be, help with the debating. And I guess he might have tried to put me in the band. And then I worked on the Federal Writers Project in the afternoon. So people have wondered about my laziness and my inertia and my not answering letters, and why didn't I write more poetry? And between teaching composition, freshman composition, and directing dramatics and other things, I still got some writing done. But I was always interested in students, and I worked hard with students, and my good students have responded to me and have told me, and I'm grateful.
Your work, though, starts with people and characters, and
yeah,
those characters create situations, so it is really a lot of theater is what your poetry is about. I think we should start at the year 1932 because that's an important year I think of in my own life, and that was the year that Southern Road first came out,
yeah,
am I right?
Yeah.
Would you tell us then how long you had been working on those poems which were finally published in 1932, where they began?
There is a bane in scholarship of dating. There is a bane of decades. If a man writes in 1899, you can put him in the 19th century, but if he's writing in the same poet's writing in 1905. You know, they don't know what century. I have colleagues who won't deal with an author unless his dates fall between, let us say, 1601 and 1699. The point that I'm making is all of this talk about a Harlem Renaissance, centering it in Harlem, is to me ridiculous, because there were a large number of poets all over the United States, and many of my poems came out in the 20s. I won an opportunity contest with the poem When the Saints Go Marching Home, and that was published by Opportunity, which was in New York. But the people leave me out, and because Southern Road came out in 32, they say I am a poet of the 30s. I am a poet of the 20s, of the 30s, and of the 40s. My first poems came out, the first poems that were in Southern Road would come out, let us say, in 1927. Poems before that, I had a few poems before that in the standard English forms that were published. One of them was in The Crisis, and I don't know whether it was one of my sisters or who sent it, but it was a poem that had appeared in a Williams College magazine, and they sent it to The Crisis, and Du Bois published it, and I wrote and asked Du Bois how he got it. I wasn't ashamed of it. I was glad it was there, but I wanted to know. He wrote me an indignant reply. He didn't know who sent it. I also put in there that I had other poems if he was interested in them, and he was not. But that was in the earliest, and one of the earliest I will later read. But 32 was the time that Southern Road came out, but 30 there were I don't know how many poems are in Southern Road, but they weren't written in the year 32. It was 32 that Harcourt Brace brought the book out, but I had been published in Caroling Dusk, which came out in the 20s. I had been published by James Weldon Johnson in his book of Negro Poetry, which came out in the 20s. Poems of mine like Odyssey of Big Boy and Long Gone had been written in the 20s. My poem Strong Men, which is one of my best known poems, was written in 1929. So 32 is only the date. I'm not a poet of the 30s. Mm. Not that I would be ashamed, but I think the 30s were much more important in the writing, American writing in general, and certainly writing of Negro life, than the 20s. I think people underestimate the 30s, because Hemingway and Dos Passos and Farrell are men coming in the 30s, and Langston's best work comes in the 30s, and Anna Bontemps' best novel, Black Thunder, comes out in 1936. I don't believe in this sharp division. The people at the right of the Harlem Renaissance never dated. Most of my fellow critics called it the New Negro Renaissance, and they were dated from 1920 to 1940, which would make more sense. But all of those dates are very arbitrary.
Although people talk of you and compare you to Walt Whitman, my own comparison is more to William Carlos Williams, who I think really put the ordinary speech on the page and changed our line length from just normal phraseology. I think that it is in this regard, I think, your contribution to American literature lies, that you really captured ordinary speech.
I'm honored by being in a class of man whose poetry I think a great deal of, and I know that he did more with the actual idiom than Walt Whitman did. Walt Whitman's vision was great, but Walt Whitman's language was not. But I think there's an intervening group there, and these I met when I was a graduate student at Harvard. I met them in Untermeyer's anthology, and that would be Edwin Arlington Robinson. And it was more his portraiture of the people, though the language, of course, was still far away from the stilted Victorian thee and thou and the poetic diction that he forswore. Nevertheless, he's not doing what Carlos Williams did. But Sandburg was catching the idiom, and Edgar Lee Masters, though I did not share his viewpoints, many of them, his handling of the idioms in the Spoon River anthology was something that was new to me. Frost was very important to me, and it was Frost, the way he handled people and handled their speech. And The Death of a Hired Man is a very important thing to me. And Robinson's Tilbury Town. But you see, this goes back farther than that. My mother was a great reader of poetry. My mother read. I remember her sweeping the floor, standing over the room, reciting to me Robert Burns, Paul Laurence Dunbar. You see, Burns is important to me. Burns is a very important for what he did with the language, how he turned away from the neoclassic high-flown Wordsworth's reaction for the speech of the people. See, I was a student of literature at Williams at Harvard, and Wordsworth, the preface to the Lyrical Ballads, that was important. Later on, Thomas Hardy's poetry was very important to me. A.E. Housman was important to me. A.E. Housman writing as a Shropshire lad. He is a professor of Greek and Latin, and great editor of Latin texts, but here's a man trying to catch in the Shropshire lad certain things. Their outlook on life was important to me. I was inclined toward the Hardy Houseman pessimism. I think it was something of a literary pose. I am still a pessimist, but, you know, sun's going to shine in my back door someday. And I still think that those are important. Now, that is not Negro folk speech. And Dunbar, my mother read me Dunbar, and I knew Dunbar. Where I got to the people whose language I wanted to get was when I started teaching. And my father and Carter Woodson urged me to go to Virginia Seminary. My father, I took the examination to teach here in Washington. My father wanted me to get out of Washington. Carter Woodson and my father urged me not to take a job in the city schools here, but to go south. My father had seen some of my poetry. My father sensed what I wanted to become. My father wanted me to become president of Howard University. But when he saw that that was not only an impossibility, but an absurdity, I think he settled for the fact that I wanted to be a poet. And whatever I was to be, he wanted me to know my people, and he wanted me to know the South. He was from Tennessee. He went to Fisk. He had a school for ministers in North Carolina that he would go to every summer for ministers who had not had chance for college or high school education. He knew the South. My roots are Southern. My mother was from Middle Tennessee. He wanted me to go to the South. I went to Virginia Seminary. Virginia Theological Seminary and College was in Lynchburg. It was desperately poor in money and very rich in spirit, very rich in race consciousness, a very militant president, and fundamentalist in religion. Many of the trustees wanted me away from there because I smoked and didn't go to chapel. But he liked me because I could sing, I could tell a good yarn, I could listen to him tell a good yarn, and I had an M.A. from Harvard, and the kids loved me.
You.
And the kids loved me, and I loved the kids. And the kids knew that I was interested in language. And there was one of them there whose name was Poodle Williams, and he was a great influence on me. He took care of me. The food in the dining hall, the teacher's food was not much superior to the student's food, and that was inferior. And Poodle, and a man who became the president of a school in Florida, I paid them a little a month, and they would fix me up a breakfast that could keep me going. And Poodle Williams was one of my best students. And when I left seminary, he took over my teaching job and used my notes, which I had left in a hurry there, and used my books, which were under the window there, and the notes in my books. And people told me he was teaching just like me. Poodle Williams was named Poodle because he was a good football player, and Howard University, one of our rivals, Howard University, would come down, and they famous player named Bulldog Williams, and Bulldog Williams burst through the line, and there was nobody between him and the goal line but little Jesse Williams, and little Jesse Williams tackled Bulldog, and they said, look at the Poodle, ruined the Bulldog, and Poodle brought him down. We would play Howard University, and Howard University, the first two quarters, we'd hold them, and then the injuries would start piling up, and then Howard would outscore us. I was a third assistant coach at Virginia Seminary, and we did not have 33 men. I had about 8 men on my squad, but I'm not here to recount my athletic proclivities, but my scholarly proclivities.
Someday we'll have to do a program on Sterling Brown, the tennis player, too. But I do want to ask
that
you...
That would be a double fault.
I want to ask if this is the time you started collecting the rich characters.
This is where the Poodle Williams saw what I was interested in and brought to my room. My room was a gathering place. I wasn't older than my students. Most of my students were older than I was, because they'd been coal miners, they were farmers, they came there, was one man, they called him Beloved, he became a preacher, they became Beloved, he was a coal miner, and he was in his 30s or so, but he was one of my students. Poodle was a little older than I think. But at any rate, they would come to my room, and Poodle brought there one day an itinerant guitar player, named Calvin Davis, but his nickname was Big Boy Davis. He had been a coal miner, but dust had gotten on him. He had black lung kind of thing, and he could not sing as loud as the people that Victor and Columbia were going to record later on. But I brought him here to Washington and did cut a record down at the Department of Interior. There was a man interested in this, but his voice wasn't big enough to get on records, but he had a wonderful repertory, and he taught me my first John Henry. I'd heard John Henry on the sidewalks here in Washington, but it was a John Henry work song. I had never heard the ballad, and he sang John Henry, but never the same way the second time. I would have to remind him. I would have to remind him of stanzas he'd left out, and when we edited The Negro Caravan, it was largely his version made chronological, because he just as soon have John Henry dying in the first stanza and sitting on his mammy's knee, Big Ben Tunnel gonna be the death of me, in the last part, do you see? That is, to him, he knew the thing so well that he wouldn't set it up as an English teacher wanted. I wanted John Henry as a baby, and then right on through, and that's what we put in the caravan, and that's what many folklorists, of course, would condemn us for doing. We ought to give it exactly as he said it, even though he would forget some of the stanzas. And he marveled at how good my memory was about him. He told me about the railroad. He was a great railroad man. And at the end of every one of his concerts, he would say, this is my mother's favorite, and he would play When the Saints Go Marching Home, and he wouldn't play anything after that. He was a great blues man. He taught me John Henry, and I thought that I had a find in this John Henry. And just at the time I was getting mine together, Guy Johnson brings out that great book he did on John Henry from the University of North Carolina Press, with 100 variants of John Henry, one of which was contributed by a cousin of my wife's. I hadn't even gone to him for it. I didn't know him then, but Guy Johnson's John Henry was an influential kind of book. Another book very influential that came out then was Cain. And that was done by a young man whom I knew here in Washington. He was older than I, but he was one of my boyhood heroes on the basketball court. This was Gene Toomer. And Cain was influential. And then James Alder Johnson's book of American Negro Poetry came out, and Langston's Weary Blues came out, and all of those were influential. But I did not go to the blues because Langston went to them. I was going to them at the same time because I was hearing them from Big Boy.
You say that at one point you say you were a pessimist, but there is not an ounce of despair in any of your poetry. In fact, it has been called the voice of affirmation.
I think stoicism and fortitude and endurance would be the qualities that I respect most. But James Weldon Johnson said that dialect was limited to two stops, pathos and humor. And I said that was wrong, that the dialect that I had heard was capable of all of these things, tragedy, stoicism, endurance, satire, irony, whatever the people were, that speech could communicate. And the Negro to me was never a figure of just pathos or humor. That's what the publishers wanted. And therefore, on the pessimism, I was renting that back farther as something congenial to me as a student of literature. Thomas Hardy's poetry was very effective to me, and Houseman. They were both pessimists, that's all I mean.
I
personally am not. I'm not a gloomy Gus. On the other hand, I am not an optimist. I think it's all right. I think it's a long pull and a long haul. I believe in packing a line. You see, As you have well pointed out, you use the word dramatic. I would use, it's correct, I would use portraiture, but it's people in action. And the stories that I tell about them, or the pictures that I give of them, are dramatic. I am in a Browning dramatic monologue tradition also. So it's people I'm interested in. And Sandburg was a model. The people, yes, came out later on. I was very pleased by it after my poetry. And he says, the people, yes. And I say, the people, yes. The people, no. The people, maybe. But the people. Now, as far as my people are concerned, I still think that one of my earliest poems points out some of their greatest, I think these are true qualities, and that's stoicism, fortitude, endurance, the ability to take it. One of the blues lines, been down so long, down don't worry me, is one kind of a line. Now, there's no question that there is tragedy in this folk speech. Two of the most tragic lines that I know are, in a spiritual, I don't know what my mother wants to stay here for. This old world ain't been no friend to her. But she did stay there, do you see? And I do not look upon the blues as one of the first critics. John Lomax wrote an article way back that offended me on self-pity in the blues, that the Negro was just running over self-pity. And he wondered what in the world the Negro had to be blue about. What the Negro had to. And I do not find self-pity as the strong note in the blues. I do find the blues full of the blues. But the blues have a lot of stoicism, a lot of irony, and a lot of joy. And one of the best lines that I use is Bess's line, I got the world in a jug, the stopper in my hand. Now that's the mood of the blues, as well as, did you ever ride on the Mobile Central Line? Did you ever ride on the Mobile Central Line? It's a line to ride to ease your worried mind. So the worried mind is in there, but the blues are too complex just for that. The blues had much to do, I think, with changing a literary pose of pessimism to an understanding of these people. But I'm getting away from the point about Big Boy came there. I visited my students. There was a huge reddish guy sitting in my class, sleeping in the corner. I was teaching him Emerson, Transcendentalism, Bronson, Alcott, Thoreau. He was sleeping. I was right out of Harvard, and I was a red ink professor. I put more red ink in the margins than they put on the black ink on the page. I was just showing off my learning. And he couldn't sleep in my class, so I sarcastically, of course, woke him up. That weekend, relatives of mine in Lynchburg took me out to where they bought butter and eggs and things like that. And we went through the woods past a place called Coolwell. Coolwell is a wide place in the road. Southern, when the Southern goes through there, it just goes whoop, 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 whoop. Gone. I mean, they don't think about stopping. They don't slow up. I mean, that's what Big Boy taught me. The train, when it gets near the crossing, whoop, two longs and two shorts. Whoop, 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 and gone through Coolwell. So Coolwell is about as big as this room. Might have a suburb in the hall. But anyway, from Coolwell, 3 miles on the reddest road, so muddy that you didn't get stuck in it. You stayed in it. The boys that would take me out there later on, we'd have to leave the car about a mile and a half from where we were going. But at any rate, this time, my relatives and friends get me down this purplish red road and through the woods, and then there's a clearing. And I saw the clearing. This is the foothills of the Blue Ridge, Coolwell. I saw this home. A log, you can't say cabin, a log house with these solemn, solid beams with this white stuff in between, very solidly built, very solid, very substantial, with a swing in the yard, with a barn and the rest. And this was the 100-acre farm of this boy of mine who slept in the class, who worked that farm Friday afternoon, Saturdays, Sundays, and got back to seminary to come to my 8 o'clock class on Monday. So from then on, he could sleep in my class. And more than that, he didn't want to sleep in my class, because after I got out there, I would go out in the woods with them and try to saw wood with the old man and work with them, work along. And he saw that I was regular, and he was regular, and we got to be very close friends. Now, his mother became one of my favorite people, and that was Sister Lou, and also in Virginia Portrait, I wrote 2 poems about her. And she and I were boon friends. And I, of course, was the learned man of the neighborhood. And all of the people around would come in on Saturday nights. I'd go there regularly. And Mrs. Bibby would be sitting where Daisy was, and I'd be sitting here. And she'd be smoking her pipe, which I gave her pipes, gave her clay pipes and corn cobs. And she could take a coal from the fire in her hands and light her pipe and put it back and not burn her hands. She had those calluses and so forth. Do it that fast. She smoked something that I think was the parent of marijuana. They called it life everlasting. She smoked a kind of a weed. But also she smoked homespun tobacco, which they made themselves. But my store-bought tobacco was superior, so I would give her my Edgeworth and my Granger, and we would smoke at each other. And she loved me, and I loved her, and she was taciturn, and I was talkative, but she was listening and smoking, and the neighbors were gathering. So one night, the neighbors get on Brother Moore, and Brother Moore, it seems, was about as trifling as anybody who came down the pike. His cows would get out in somebody's cornfield. He never watered his horses right. Everything was wrong. But every time somebody said something about Brother Moore, somebody would pipe up, "But he means good. But he means good. But he means good." And finally, after one of the worst things in the world had been mentioned about him, somebody piped up, "But he means good." And Ma Bibby took that pipe out of her mouth and spat precisely at the fireplace. She never missed. She hit the exact coal that she wanted, ping like that. Me, when I spat, I kind of strewed the place because I was not, you know, trained in that at Harvard. I didn't know how to spit in a fireplace, so I wasn't very neat. But she went, she took the pipe out of her mouth, ping, it went on there, man. She says the following. Well, he may mean good, but he do, so doggone po', which I think is one of the best aphorisms that I've heard. Langston Hughes and Arnold Buntoms put it in their book of aphorisms, but it was my aphorism that I picked up from Sister Bibby. Now, she is Sister Lou. So I would go to visit my students. I went all in the backwoods. I went in the churches. I went to the meetings. I went in the fields with them. I worked in the fields with them. I worked with old man Bibby. Old man Bibby had, had a stroke. But before he had a stroke, they used to sell white oak posts to the Southern Railroad. They had wonderful forests. Mm. And they would be sawing there. And I sawed with him. I would take the saw. But I was so anxious to show my machoism, my virility, that he'd have one end of the saw and I'd have the other. And you see, you're supposed to pull it and then let it slide back. But I'd not only push it, I'd push it back to him, which was wrong. That broke the rhythm. You pull, and then he pulls, you see. So we're sawing. And I'm there sweating, you know, overworking. And he says to me, take your time, son, and don't try to raise no hell. Now, these, I said the other night that I learned the arts and sciences at Williams and Harvard, but I learned the humanities at seminary. I was talking about Mother Bibby, and this is a poem in which, in her idiom, I'm trying to give her picture. Sister Lou, honey, when the man calls out the last train you're gonna ride, tell him howdy. Gather up your basket and your knitting and your things and go on up and visit with friend Jesus for a spell. Show Martha how to make your green grape jellies and give poor Lazarus a parcel of them golden biscuits. Scald some meal for some right down good spoon bread for little box plunkin' David. And sit around and tell them Hebrew children all your stories. Honey, don't be afeard of them pearly gates. Don't go around to the back. No more that away. Not ever no more. Let Michael tote your burden in your pocketbook and everything except your Bible, while Gabriel blows something solemn but loudsome on that horn of his'n. Honey, go straight on to the big house and speak to your God without no fear and trembling. Then sit down and pass the time of day a while. Give a good talking to your favorite apostle Peter, and rub the bull head of mixed-up Judas, and joke a while with Jonah. Then, when you get the chance, always remembering your raisin, let them know you's tired, just my tired. Jesus will find your bed for you. Will no servant ever bother with your room? Jesus will lead you to a room with windows opening on cherry trees and plum trees blooming everlasting. And that will be yours for keeps. Then take your time. Honey, take your blessed time. Other poems connected with my discovery of folk speech and characters my interest in my people would be about Calvin Davis, and this is his Odyssey, Odyssey of Big Boy. Let me be with Casey Jones, let me be with Stagger Lee, let me be with such like men when death takes hold on me, when death takes hold on me. Done skinned as a boy in Kentucky hills, drove steel there as a man. Done stripped tobacco in Virginia fields, alongst the River Dan, alongst the River Dan. Done mined the coal in West Virginia like that job just fine, till a load of slate curved round my head. Won't work in no more mine, won't work in no more mine. Done shocked the corn in Maryland, in Georgia, done cut cane. Done planted rice in South Carolina, but won't do that again, do that no more again. Been roused about in Memphis, dock hand in Baltimore. Done smashed up freight on Norfolk wharves, a first-class stevedore, a first-class stevedore. Done slung hash yonder in the north on the old Fall River line. Done busted suds in little New York, which ain't no work of mine, Lord, ain't no work of mine. Done worked and loafed on such like jobs, seeing what they is to see. Done had my time with a pint on my hip and a sweet gal on my knee, sweet mama on my knee. Had stovepipe blonde in Macon, yellow gal in Maryland. In Richmond had a chocolate brown, called me her monkey man, her big fool monkey man. Had two fair browns in Arkansas and three in Tennessee. Had Creole gal in New Orleans, so God did two-time me, Lord, two-time, full-time me. But best gal what I ever had done put it over them, a gal in Southwest Washington at 4.5 an M, 4.5 an M. Done took my living as it came, done risked my joy, done grabbed my joy, done risked my life. Train done caught me on the trestle, man done caught me with his wife, his doggone pretty wife. I done had my women, I done had my fun. Can't do much complaining when my jag is done. Lord, Lord, my jag is done. And all that big boy axes when time comes for the go, let me be with John Henry, steel driving man. Let me be with old Jazzbo. Let me be with old Jazzbo. And the second about him is called Long Gone. I like your kind of loving, ain't never caught you wrong, but it just ain't natural for to stay here long. It just ain't natural for a railroad man with a itch for traveling he can't understand. I looks at the rails and I looks at the ties, and I hears an old freight puffing up the rise. And at nights on my pallet when all is still, I listens for the empties bumping up the hill. When I gotta be quiet, I's gotta itch for to hear the whistle blow, for the crossing or the switch. And I knows the times are nearing when I got to ride, though it's home-like and happy at your sign. You has done all you could do to make me stay. Tain't no fault of yours as leaving, as just that away. I has got to see some people I ain't never seen. Got a highball through some country I ain't never been. I don't know which way I'm traveling, far or near. All I know for certain is I can't stay here. You know, call it all, sweet woman, for the carry-on. Just my name and just my habit to be long gone.